Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with the samples. I've been battling allergies for years now. Let me tell you, they've been a real ordeal in my life. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to ClaritinD.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
You right. Don't want to be the kid in class who says, who admits, I don't know the answer. And it's only when you're an adult that you realize, no, there's actually a lot of power and a lot of strength that comes from just admitting that and saying, no, I don't know this. Can you teach me? And it can be good for you, but also good for whatever partnerships that you have, whether it's inside your organization or outside.
What's up, gang? Welcome to The Greatness Machine. I'm your host, Darius Mirshazadeh. I'm so pumped to have you here with me. Now listen, The Greatness Machine, we're about two things. Number one, people who are living their passions. And number two, those who are creating greatness in the world and doing both of these things despite the odds against them. Each episode, we're going to feature interviews with game changers, business leaders, you know, telling us their origin stories, what made them tick, what got them to where they are now. Why? So it can help you step into your greatness within your life, your business, and your career. Occasionally, you might hear a few solo episodes from myself, moi as I say, as I leverage my 20 years of entrepreneurship as a CEO and founder to help you grow and level up in your journey to scale your life and your business. So come be a fly on the wall, enjoy the conversation, and I'm stoked to have you here with me. Guys, welcome to The Greatness Machine. I'm your host, Darius Mirshazadeh, and boy, do we have a special guest today. My main man, Chris Hill, is in the house. Chris, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Darius. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man. I've been so excited for this. So, listeners of The Greatness Machine, you guys know that we're about two things. We're about people who are living their passions and those who are creating greatness in the world. And Chris is neither short of passion nor greatness. So, I sent my team out on a hunt. And for, you know, for listeners of the show, you may not know this. I'm going to give you some, I'm going to bare my soul right now a little bit, but, a lot of the guests are, I've really worked my network really hard to go and find guests. I know we've done about almost 200 shows now. And I said, man, I got to get out of my comfort zone. I got to go find other greatness outside of the Darius network. So I set Noah and the team hunting and I said, you know, and this is, and Chris, this is really pertinent to you because you're going to know what was the premise on why we hit you up. And so I said, hey, let's go hit up top 100 podcasts. Let's go find the hosts of these shows, right? I want to talk to these guys and girls because, you know, they've done something super cool that I'm trying to do. And, you know, I want to build a top podcast and we're in the process of doing that. So let's go. Cause that's no small feat. So we went out, we've been, you know, beating the bushes and we hit up Chris because he runs one of the top podcasts in the world. Actually, it's Motley Fool Money. And we'll be talking all about that on the show, but that was the reason why we hit you up, Chris. I don't know if you knew that or not. And that's what brought us here today.
I did not know that, but I was flattered to get the invite and looking forward to the conversation.
Definitely. So I do want to give a little bit of your formal bio and then I'd love to dive right in. Are you cool with that?
Absolutely.
Awesome. So you guys, Chris Hill is the director of audio programming at The Motley Fool and the host of It's Motley Fool Money podcast. So it's you probably have heard it. They're all over, you know, syndicated all over the country, if not all over the world. That's actually a question I have for you, but you oversee The Motley Fool's audio programming and business strategies. And you also narrated the best-selling book, The Psychology of Money. And for listeners of the show, you know, I'm about all things core values. And Chris, his top three core values are take a breath, take a break, and go for it. So, man, welcome to the show. I'm so, so pumped to have you here.
It's great to be here. I love these types of conversations.
You know, yeah, you know, it's I think it's interesting to see where the world of media is going to. And, you know, I think that conversations make the world go round, and obviously podcast has taken a huge leap in the forefront of what media is today, and you've been a big part of that. You know, I'd love for you if you could take us back. I mean, right now you're doing all these amazing things at Motley Fool. I did a lot of research on your background at Motley Fool. You've been there since 97, came out of American University with a master's and went right into the Motley Fool world. But if you don't mind, like, take us back a little bit. How did you get into what you're doing right now?
So I graduated from Boston College in 1990, worked for a few years, and found a weekend master's program in public communication at American University. I had moved from Boston to DC, and I enjoyed my job at the time, so I wasn't looking to leave work and go to school full time. So I basically had no life for close to 2 years because I was working during the week and going to school on the weekends. And when I came out of that, started looking around, and my background is in media and communications, and the Motley Fool was a company I had not heard of. It was a very small and young company at the time, and they were looking for someone to head up media and PR. And so really for the first, I would say, dozen or so years at the company, that's mainly what I was doing, sort of dealing with the media a lot, being involved in PR partnerships that our company would have, all that sort of thing. But because we were a small company, there was a lot of opportunity to do things beyond sort of whatever is your core job. And so one of the first things I worked on in 1997 was the Motley Fool radio show, sort of the creation of, we started getting contacted by radio syndicators who were interested in taking the Motley Fool brand, which had a successful website, and David and Tom Gardner, the co-founders of the company, had written a couple of best-selling books about investing. And so then it sort of like, hey, what would you guys think about doing a weekly radio show? So I was involved in that behind the scenes. Cut to it's the Great Recession is happening in 2008. And my boss at the time, we were no longer doing a radio show. And my boss at the time, as you know, as our economy in America was melting down, and our business, like a lot of businesses, was really being challenged, because when the market starts tanking, there are a lot of people who don't want to be invested in the stock market. Even though all of the data shows the longer you can hang in, the longer you can stay invested, the better you're going to do as an investor.
Sure.
But a lot of people just bail on that. And the main economic engine of the Motley Fool is investing newsletter services. So we had people sort of canceling their service at the time because they were just scared. And understandably so. It was a really scary time for the economy. But my boss at the time said, hey, should we think about doing a radio show again? And I sort of, you know, put some thoughts together on paper and ended up writing this 5-page memo that sort of boiled down to, if we ever want to do radio again, we should try doing a podcast, which was a new medium in late 2008, early 2009.
Sure.
But I sort of laid out the reasons why. And we knew that David and Tom Gardner would not be able to host the show because they were busy leading our company and trying to keep us going during a tough time. And so the show that we created was sort of a smaller weekly version of the show we do now. It's still Motley Fool Money, but we launched that in February of 2009, and it was just me and a couple of our analysts spending 12 to 15 minutes really trying to do what we do at the Motley Fool, which is try to help people make sense of what's happening with businesses and what's happening on Wall Street.
So, taking a step back to this early, you know, doing a radio show, did you ever, I mean, and you know, for listeners who are maybe a little younger, you know, podcast is in the zeitgeist now. That's like, I heard a joke that said, like, you know, this is like a year ago, they said a podcast in 2021 is like a cup of coffee in 2017, you know, like you invite people to come on your podcast, right? And there's a lot of people that have podcasts. It's not, you know, the barrier to entry to open a podcast, the barrier to entry for all this content is much lower than it's ever been. But going back to 1997, right, and going back to the early 2000s, you know, and I'll just frame up, like, 1997, like Howard Stern was like probably one of the top radio shows in the country, right? And it's still a big show that on, I think it's on Sirius Radio. But, you know, radio was where it was at. And I think, I feel like podcast is kind of a it's a version of what radio has always been, right? If you think of it, it's kind of very similar, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that once I started listening to podcasts on my own around the same time, you know, 2007, 2008, the convenience of it and the fact that it's a nascent media at the time. And so there's not really a lot of commercialization. There's not a lot of ads, that sort of thing. I just remember thinking, oh, I think this is going to be pretty big. I think once this catches on, once more people have smartphones and there are more programming options, people are going to find the thing that they like to listen to. And I remember early on, because we had done Motley Fool Money for about a year when we made the conscious decision to expand the program to fit, because we already had the experience in producing a syndicated radio show, first on commercial radio, then through NPR.
That's right.
We figured out we can do what amounts to a weekly 1 hour radio show for commercial radio. And we syndicated it ourselves. We still do. At the moment, it's on 75 radio stations. And really, that just came about from me contacting radio stations. And they were familiar with the Motley Fool brand. I would send them sort of a sample of the show, that sort of thing. And just sort of lay out like, hey, here's our show. You guys get to keep all the advertising revenue. We're not looking to monetize this show with advertising on radio stations. And I remember early on talking with program directors. This is, you know, 2010, 2011, and podcasting is growing, but it's still pretty nascent. And one of the things I would say to program directors was, hey, look, you know, don't just take my word for it. Go on to iTunes and look at the reviews, because there are people who are writing reviews on our show. And there was a lot, I ran into so much skepticism from program directors, and, you know, including a bunch who would just say, you know, this podcasting thing is a fad,
right,
and it's not going to last. And it, you know, I didn't feel like it was my place to tell them, nah, actually you're wrong about this. And talk radio is in more trouble than it thinks if it's going to completely ignore podcasting.
Yeah.
And, you know, ours was the first show to make the leap from podcasting to also being available on commercial radio. And what you've seen since then is so many radio shows that are on far more stations than we are following suit and saying, okay, I want to make my show available to a podcasting audience as well.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So going back to the world of Motley Fool, like, it sounds like obviously you had an interest in media. You went and got your master's in it and then got in with Motley Fool. Did you always have an interest in investing, or was that kind of secondary?
That was secondary. My interest in investing was minimal at best when I started working at the Motley Fool in 1997. And one of the things I love about working at the company, and it's always been the case, is there was an encouragement throughout the company for everyone, regardless of what their job was, to learn about investing. It was just a very open culture in terms of encouraging people to be intellectually curious and ask questions and be upfront about, you know, really putting into practice the idea that there is no such thing as a dumb question. You know, just come out with even the most basic things like, well, what is a PE ratio and how do you calculate, you know,
right.
Just really try and encourage people to get over that hurdle. You know, one of those things that when you're a kid and you're in school, the three words that just strike terror in your heart are, I don't know. You don't want to, right. You don't want to be the kid in class who admits, I don't know the answer. And it's only when you're an adult that you realize, no, there's actually a lot of power and a lot of strength that comes from just admitting that and saying, no, I don't know this. Can you teach me? And it can be good for you, but also good for whatever partnerships that you have, whether it's inside your organization or outside.
Yeah, so interesting. You know, and in conscious leadership, we call that knower versus learner, right? And this having this learner mindset, there's a word in Japanese, shoshin, you know, having that beginner's mind, right? And I feel like that's, you know, starting to get more and more celebration these days. And going back to the beginner's mind of walking into a Motley Fool, how many people were at Motley Fool when you got there in 97?
There were about 40 people when I started working there.
Wow, that's a really much. And how big are you guys right now?
About 600. Yeah,
people don't think about that, but that's, you know, a 15x, right? So that's like the difference between a 1,000-person organization and a 15,000-person organization. You know, that's a huge difference. And my former company, we grew it from about 30 to 1,000 people. And when you start, you know, those are two different businesses. Those are two different businesses five times over, you know? So having, going into a Motley Fool at 40 people, you know, and you know, it's interesting, a question for you, I guess, because it sounds like you, when I did research on this, you guys partnered with AOL, which was, you know, they were an up and coming behemoth. You know, in 94, they were new, but by the late 90s, they were really a beast, right? And so, you know, I think if someone was trying to go into media back then, it's not like you would have been like, yeah, I'm going to pick this random company of 40 people in it that you never heard of, you know, versus an AOL or Time Warner or these, or NBC or something like that. So like, what prompted you, what attracted you to Motley Fool versus these big like media conglomerates?
I really loved the scrappiness of the organization. I loved the mission of really trying to demystify Wall Street. And again, I never had any formal education when it came to investing. And I really identified with what David and Tom Gardner and Eric Rideholm, the third co-founder, and Gary Hill, who was the CFO at the time, just the leadership of the company. They were really trying to almost shake the world, and in particular Americans, out of this idea that had been drummed into everyone's head for decades. And the idea was, investing is really hard. You shouldn't try and do it yourself. It's unbelievably complicated. You shouldn't do it. You should let the professionals help you with this. And really what the Motley Fool was born out of was that idea of like, no, actually the math required to be good at investing is the math we all learned in grade school. It's not advanced trigonometry. It's not physics. It's multiplication, division, addition, subtraction. It's the basics. And really reorienting mindsets from stocks to businesses, from getting people to stop thinking about stocks as a piece of paper that you trade and think about instead about you're becoming part owner of a business. And all of that really was just so compelling to me. And I just thought, yeah, I want to be a part of what this company's trying to do.
That's so cool. It's funny. So I can't remember the name of it, but it's a thing for kids, right? And it's basically like a debit card, and you like do their allowance on it, right? It's a newer thing. And I got little kids. I got an 8-year-old and 12-year-old. And so, but in this thing, gosh, it's killing me. I pull it out if I wasn't blanking on the name of it right now. You can invest in stocks. Like you buy like fractional pieces of stock. So my 8-year-old like loves Tesla, like wants me to buy a Tesla. He's like, Dad, you got to buy a Tesla. And I'm like, listen, I don't want to buy a Tesla, but you can buy Tesla stock. He's like, really? I'm like, yeah, you can own part of the company, man. So he owns Tesla stock and during like Halloween last year, I'm like, hey, like, do you want to invest in some chocolate, man? So we bought like a little bit of Hershey's. And so I'm trying to teach him what you're talking about right now, which is, to your point, you're not buying a scrap of paper or a share of the stock. You're an owner in that company. You're a shareholder. Like, it's, if you own enough shares, you would control the company. In some companies, right? So, you know, when you think of like your transition from going into this investor, when you start looking at, you know, this idea of what we're talking about right now, which is financial literacy, how do you feel about, you know, the state of financial literacy and how Motley Fool plays into making that, I guess, more abundant and more available to the general population?
I like what we're trying to do in terms of financial literacy. It's always been one of the parts of our business that I love the most. And, you know, we're a for-profit business, but so much of our content is freely available. You know, the podcast is available for anyone to download. Fool.com is our main website, and there are hundreds of articles published every week. most of them being about individual companies. In terms of the state of financial literacy, I really thought we'd be further along. Like if you had asked me in 1997, where do you think financial literacy is going to be in 25 years? And where do you think stock ownership for Americans is going to be in 25 years? I would have said, without hesitating, both are going to be much more significant. And in fact, when it comes to stock ownership, we're still about where we were 25 years ago. I think it's slightly higher, but it's, you know, just over 50% of Americans own stock, either directly or through some sort of retirement planning, a 401k plan, 403b, that sort of thing. I really thought we'd be further along. So, you know, part of me thinks we're doing better, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Do you think it's that people don't understand it? Or do you think it's that we live in a country where, you know, majority of the population lives paycheck to paycheck? So this idea of buying investing in some stock is like, yeah, I don't have any extra money, bud, or else I'd do it. You know, what do you think that is?
Yeah, I think for a significant portion of people, it's absolutely what you just said, Darius. It's people are living paycheck to paycheck. Their financial priorities are not on investing for the future. But there's also a significant chunk of people who do have the means to save, to invest. And I think, part of it is, the most, as my friend Morgan Housel says, when people think about being a millionaire, they don't think about having $1 million. They think about how much fun it would be to spend $1 million. And let's face it, that's the fun part of money. True. Is the spending of the money. So I think, you know, there are a number of barriers that people need to get over before they start sort of putting money away. And it's not taught in schools the way it should be. I really think, and even the way it's taught in some schools, where there are stock market investing contests, I understand the appeal of that from the teacher standpoint, from a curriculum standpoint, but from an investing standpoint, it inadvertently teaches the wrong lesson because we're going to have a contest and it's, who can pick a stock and in 10 weeks, whichever stock has gone up the most, that person wins. It's like, that's a terrible lesson for kids who are better suited to benefit from long-term investing than certainly people like me in their mid-50s.
Yeah, that's it. Like, you're like, boss, can I buy the Bitcoin ETF? Because, because there's like literally, it's like, I want literally the most highest alpha and I don't care if it goes to zero, you know, like that's how you win that competition. To your point, like, that is the opposite of a long-term perspective, right? You're literally stock picking based off of what something's going to do in 10 weeks. And you know, it's like short-termism. It's not this idea that, go the other way. Like, what do you want to own forever? And yeah, I may have if I'm teaching that class, I'm saying you can't tell what a business is going to do in 10 weeks. You can tell what it's going to do in 10 years, right? You know, like maybe if they have the right leadership and the right strategy, you're not going to see that in 10 weeks. I love that idea. You know, going back to this, idea of investing and I guess the role media plays in it. So you're actively involved in, you know, one of the most popular podcasts in the world when it comes to investing. You know, I look at, you know, I'm a avid consumer consumptor of financial media. Like I geek out on it all the time. And one of the things I've noticed is, unfortunately, at least this is my perspective at the moment, is you have it's almost like what we're seeing politically in this country, where the extremes get the talk time, right? Where the ultra bear and the ultra bull are the ones that people want to hear from, right? And the more logical middle, the boring Charlie Mungers of the world and Warren Buffett's, like, you know, the only reason people want to hear from Charlie is because he's so wealthy, right? And he's done so well over, you know, 90 years, but yet I hear people, and a lot of these people are just straight up talking heads, saying interest rates 10%, 50-80% stock market crash, you know, and you see it and it's like just clickbait and it's all over. And I remember I was looking at this and I'm like, this is, you know, this is totally irresponsible. Like, it's not like, and I get it because it's fear and greed, right? We're pushing this idea of fear and greed. So like, what are your thoughts around, I guess, overcoming that, A, and B, around the fact that it exists the way it does?
The good news for investors, kind of like earlier in the conversation when we were talking about, you know, just the medium of radio. And for younger listeners, they're like, what, radio? Who? Like my grandpa listens to talk radio, you know, that sort of thing. It's the same way in investing, that there are things that used to exist 25 years ago that when I talk to younger investors, they look at me like I'm crazy. It's like, what do you mean stocks used to have fractions attached to them? You know, it's like the movie Wall Street from 1987 is a classic film. It still holds up. But, you know, there are some things in there that have changed. And one of them is when the ticker goes by, it's like, oh, this stock is trading at 52 3/8, that sort of thing. So I think of it this way, Darius. The good news for investors today is there's more information available than ever before, because Wall Street really used to be a closed system and it was so difficult to get information for individual investors like you and me. So the good news is we have more information at our fingertips than ever before. That's also the bad news, because it can be so distracting. And you know, part of what we try and do on our podcast is really try and separate the signal from the noise. Because there's so much information. You can get Starbucks' latest earnings report anywhere. And so what we try and do in our show is sort of dig into like, okay, well, what do we think this means? Because you're right. If I were a producer of television on, you know, daytime on Bloomberg or CNBC or Fox Business, I would absolutely go looking for a bull and a bear. You know, because that's sort of the classic thing. And, you know, the more hyperbole, the better. But in general, the more time you can spend with a business, the more time you can spend with a story, the greater your ability to sort of get beyond the shouting and the headlines and find out like, okay, well, where is this business going? You know, you had mentioned something earlier about I think you used the word forever. In sort of looking out in terms of investing. And that's part of what we try and do is look at something like, don't tell me about what's hot right now. Tell me about sort of where is the world going? What direction is it going in? And do we think there's going to be more of this trend in the future or less of this trend? You know, I've made the joke before that one of the reasons I own shares of Sherwin-Williams, the paint company, about as boring a business as you can find, is because in the history of the world, no one has ever walked into a new home or a new apartment and said the following sentence out loud. All these colors look great, and I'm not changing any of them. Like, people are like, that's never going to change, Darius. It's never going to change. We're always going to be picking new paint colors. Yeah. And so why not own a few shares of a company with a track record like Sherwin-Williams? And so that's, you know, increasingly in my investing life, and that's what I'm trying to do, is look for the things that I think are, you know, almost undeniable in terms of this is something that is going to keep going. This is not going to change because technology changes. You talked about AOL. AOL used to be not only the most dominant internet service provider in America, it changed the way we access information. The 1990s was the decade when America got online. So who better than AOL to benefit from that? And now AOL is something you need to explain to younger people.
I love when I see people have AOL email addresses still. I'm like, it's like driving a classic car. You know,
yes.
What is that? That's a 67 Chevy.
Yeah,
I love it. And you're making such a great point. It's that, you know, that's this timelessness of investing and, you know, I hadn't heard that corollary before regarding Sherwin-Williams, but it's a great point. Like, I was talking to my wife yesterday because we were having to match paints for a building we own in San Francisco that we picked the wrong color white and we have to go repaint the whole kitchen. So to your point, like, no one's ever going to stop painting their houses. The question is how much they're going to repaint them, right? It's not if or when. I say the same thing about haircuts. It's like, yeah, like, haircut business isn't going anywhere, you know? Like I'm not going to let a robot cut my hair anytime soon that I can probably agree on. And even then, there's still going to be a business involved. So it's a question, will a human be the one doing it? This episode is brought to you by Shopify. In the world of successful partnerships, names like Procter & Gamble, Ben & Jerry, and supply and demand echo through business history. But when it comes to growing your business, who are the perfect partners? That's you and Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. We're talking from launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to did we hit $1 million order stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Picture this, a time when my business was facing a tough hurdle and I wasn't sure how to break through. But then came the breakthrough moment, a game changer that took my business to the next level. You know, what I absolutely adore about Shopify is its unparalleled ability to adapt and grow with your ambitions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 75 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Darius, all lowercase. That's D-A-R-I-U-S. Go to shopify.com/Darius now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/Darius. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with the samples. Hey there, friends. It's Darius Mashazda here, and I have a little confession to make. You see, I've been battling allergies for years now, and let me tell you, they've been a real ordeal in my life. Allergies have been my constant companion. They stop me from fully enjoying the little things in life, canceling plans with friends because of sudden allergy attack, to missing out on an outdoor activity because of sneezing fits. Allergies have been a real nuisance. Luckily, for those of us who live with symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing and a runny nose, itchy, watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been a Claritin D user for many, many years now, and let me tell you, it's made a world of difference. Since I started using Claritin D, my symptoms have improved dramatically. Now, I can breathe easier, enjoy outdoor activities without worrying about sneezing fits, and truly live my life without being held back by allergies. Ready to live as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter now. You don't even need a prescription. Go to ClaritinD.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear, use as directed.
Hey gang, Darius Mashazda here. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. So listen, I know we have a lot of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and business owners out there that listen to the show. And right now, if you're one of those folks and you're doing, let's call it, a bare minimum of 7 figures and above in your business, then what I'd like to do is give you an offer right now. How would you like to get your hands on the frameworks that I actually used to scale my last company, which started off as a small little 7-figure company, to over $100 million in annual revenue? And I did it in less than 2 years, and I did it without costly growing pains, without the headaches that you usually experience when you are scaling your businesses. So if you're one of those folks and you're trying to grow your company, but you're finding yourself stuck in that day-to-day, if you're one of the listeners and you're getting grinded, this is your respite from getting grinded on your business, you're listening to our show, and you're dealing with the breakdowns, you're dealing with inefficiencies, and you know, you got that firefighter suit on and all the problems lining on your desk, and you're not doing the work you're supposed to be doing, which is working on the business instead of in it, then what I'm about to talk to you about for the next, call it 60 seconds, this is precisely for you. Real quickly, though, if you don't already know this about me, prior to starting The Greatness Machine, I spent 20 years of my life as a founder and CEO of real-world companies. And during that time, I actually grew my companies to over $1.2 billion with a B in bootstrap revenue. In fact, we scaled my last company from 30 to 1,000 employees, and we did it in just 36 months. And we did it all by using a three-step framework that I call my Scale Map Method. So that, of course, brings us to the purpose of this here mid-roll ad. Yes, this is what the podcast producers call these things. Recently, I created a 30-minute training, and what it does is it walks you step-by-step through all of my Scale Map Method frameworks, and you can watch it right now for free when you go to DariusScale.com. That's my first name, Darius, Scale, S-C-A-L-E.com. And what these frameworks do is they fix, they simplify, and they streamline every single aspect of your business, and they do it without the need for complicated scaling systems that are typically way too difficult and way too time consuming for a busy CEO like you and like myself was to implement. So if you want a simple and you want a proven path to remove yourself from the day-to-day operations, just like I did, so that you can do what you're supposed to be doing, which is leading your company to record growth without the headaches and without the growing pains, go to DariusScale.com. That's www.DariusScale.com. Watch the short video, and I'll see you guys on the inside. Now, back to the show.
I have a question for you. So, and you just kind of brought this up because, you know, and obviously Motley Fool is an example of this, but, you know, what advice can you give to listeners who are trying to find high quality information and commentary on the markets? I think a lot of people are probably not like you and me that, you know, you spent a lot of time working at an investing media company where, you know, it's now become a part of who you are. For me, I'm probably one of the small percentage of people that go get an accounting degree and then geek out on the stock market when they're in the teenagers still. You know, I know that we're not the norm. The norm is it's intimidating. They're afraid. They think they're going to lose their money. Where can people find high quality media so that they can go and start to get more comfortable? If they are comfortable with it, what would be sources that you love that or where people can get that high quality information?
There's no shortage of information out there. I think part of it is, you know, it's a little bit akin to, I'm a fan of movies. It's a little bit akin to finding a movie reviewer who you sort of sync with. Because, you know, there are times where I'll read a movie review and I'll think, oh, okay, great. And then you find out just like in school, there are professors right. who are easy graders. There are movie reviewers who are, it's like, this movie was terrible. What were they talking about? You know, that sort of thing. So I think part of it is just finding sources that sort of fit your temperament. There is no one size fits all. You know, one of my colleagues says, when it comes to personal finance, it's much more Definitely. Personal than finance. Because everybody's situation is different. Everybody's risk tolerance is different. And that's okay. So I think part of it for people who are just starting out and looking to get started investing is just sort of figuring out, okay, what is my tolerance? And tolerance is something that is revealed to you over time. Because in general, people, they tend to get their tolerance wrong. You think, you know, and it goes both ways. There are people who think they have a really high tolerance, and then the market drops like it did right. in the first half of this year, and then they can't sleep at night, and it's really bothering them. It's like, okay, so what have we learned? We've learned your tolerance right. is not as high as it was. And I think part of it is, you know, so that's part of it is just sort of figuring out what your tolerance is. And then also, as a general rule of thumb, the businesses that have been the best performing stocks for me are the businesses that I understand the best. So that's another misconception about investing that we've been trying to knock down for 25 plus years. Because it's the myth of somebody whispers a ticker symbol or it's some company and they do this thing and I can't really explain what they do. They're this high tech or they're doing gene splicing or whatever it is. When really, some of the best performing businesses not only are all around us; they're businesses that are easy to understand. My best performing stock is Starbucks. It's a coffee company. I mean, It's the lemonade stand that we all started when we were kids, except they're selling a legally addictive product. So I would start with those two things, is like, try to figure out what your tolerance is and start with companies that you understand the business. David Gardner, who's one of the co-founders of The Motley Fool, has his own weekly podcast, which I recommend as well, called Rule Breaker Investing. You know, David has said for a long time that the first two questions to ask about any business are questions that anyone can ask. And the first question is, how does this company make money? And if the answer to that is highly convoluted and to the point where you don't understand it, then maybe go find another company to ask that question about. The first question is, how does this company make more money? And the second question is, how do they plan to make more money in the future? Because that's what's going to reward shareholders, their ability to generate more profits in the future. But yeah, I think the start with businesses that you can wrap your head around. You know, one of the smartest people on our investing team, I remember talking with him years ago, and we were talking about the big banks, like the big Wall Street banks, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, you know, Citi, Bank of America. And he said, I don't invest in those. I was like, really? You've never? He said, no. I said, why not? And he said, because I feel like I don't have an advantage. There is a black box element to the way the big banks make money. And so I'm not going to spend my time trying to unlock that.
Yeah, especially like you start looking at like a JP Morgan Chase, right? The trillions under management. It's like, to your point, there's a quote that I learned about a decade ago, which you reminded me of it earlier on the show, which is there's margin and mystery, right? And it's like these banks, like I have a banking background. I ran a large servicing mortgage bank that I built with my business partners. And I look at some of the ways we made money and it would blow your mind. It's because, you know, we had $100 billion of mortgages that were, you know, collecting their payments and you get a float, you know, on between the time that you collect their taxes and you got to pay their taxes. Right. And I'm like, that was like a majority of some of the revenue that came in through the door, not the actual work you do. And then the banks are like, no, that's the game. When you start looking at big banks, it's around how much do you have in there that you can kind of like divvy up. Right. I have a question for you, though. And this is, you know, I think it's kind of the timing of this conversation is interesting. You know, in the investing world, you know, you and I have been through a few cycles. I'm in my 40s. It sounds like you're in your 50s. You know, we've seen a few cycles. And in this last cycle, I'm in a couple investment groups. And I kept finding myself saying, everyone's rich now. You know, it's a lot. And I live in Austin, Texas, which there's a ton of crypto. Maybe there's less now. But I heard 80,000 crypto millionaires that were made last year that have now lost their status as crypto millionaires. When you guys start looking at, you know, the trends, I mean, it feels very similar to the, you know, 1997, 98, you know, first.com, where you're in this early stage technology. There's tons of people running to it. What do you guys, you know, what is your position, you know, as a media outlet for investing when it comes to this world of crypto? And you guys are seeing like what's your guys' take on that?
So this is my opportunity to point out that one of the words in my company's name is Motley. Which we interpret as colorful and diverse. So there is a diversity of opinion when it comes to crypto. I don't invest in crypto because I don't invest in any currency. I invest in stocks and ETFs. So in general, we don't talk a lot about crypto on the podcast, but we, you know, we have people who cover it. There are certainly articles on fool.com. That sort of thing. It, you know, to go back to my colleague when he was talking about big banks, there's an element to crypto that I just sort of don't get in the same way that I'm just chalking up to time.
Right.
It's like, how do I want to spend my time as an investor? And I feel like my time is much better spent looking at companies, the companies that I own shares of, but, you know, the ones that are on my watch list, that sort of thing. I definitely don't have any sort of advantage when it comes to crypto or currencies in general. So I generally stay away from it. The bread and butter of what we do on the show is about stocks. And so
do you have stocks? I appreciate that input, because I do think that there's a lot, and I have a little bit of crypto, but I've interviewed a few people who are experts in it, and it's the Wild West, man. It's cool. I think that there's I come from a financial services background. I look at it and I'm like, this is probably the future of how financial transactions operate on blockchain, right? The currency side of it, the TBD, might be zero, right? But the technology itself, I think, is interesting. Back to this idea of what we are listening to, are there any, I'm a fan of a lot of the different perspectives out there. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm a huge fan of Warren Buffett's and Charlie Munger's. On the other side of the fence is someone like a Ray Dalio, who is, I feel like there's a lot of sage wisdom amongst those three names, but they have very, very different perspectives of what's going to happen in the world. One is much more optimistic, much more pessimistic, and then you see people like Cathie Wood, who gets, so much, of the oxygen in the room. And I'm not a fan of hers, but, when you start to look at the different, when you guys are, I guess, looking at the different, people who are considered the leaders of the investment space right now, who do you guys like? Who do you guys maybe not want to give so much attention to? Are you at liberty of saying that?
I really appreciate the way you have just laid this out, Darius, because it's something that I think is easy for people to miss when it comes to the financial media. And this is true of people. And I think this is true of companies too, that there are some that just take up a ton of oxygen and so much attention, and to depersonalize it, I think Twitter is a good example of a company that gets an outsized amount of attention, considering its size as a public company and its track record as a business. It hasn't been great. I understand why Apple and Microsoft and Amazon get the attention they do.
It's crazy.
The fact that Twitter gets the attention it does, I think, is due to a variety of things, including the fact that a lot of people, myself included, use Twitter. I find it to be a helpful tool in following news and finding information. But as a business, it's not that great. So in a couple of weeks, we're going to have an event for our members. It's our first in-person event in 3 years. And one of the people who's going to be appearing is Michael Mobison, who's an investor who is not really a household name. He certainly doesn't get the attention that Cathie Wood or Bill Ackman get. But I would put Michael Mobison on the short list of investors that people on the Motley Fool's investing team would love to have dinner with, just sort of listen to, pick their brain, that sort of thing. And so I would put Mobison on that list. You mentioned Charlie Munger and Buffett. It's not just their track record, which is impressive given their age, but it's also something else you keyed on, Darius, and it's their optimism. I think fundamentally, if you're going to be an investor, there is an element of optimism that you need to adopt. What is investing if not an act of optimism? It's economic optimism. I believe this company is going to be more valuable in the future and will reward shareholders more in the future than it does today. So I think trying to find those people, it's not to say that you want people who go through the world with rose-colored glasses and everything's going to be awesome, because as to go back to what we were talking about earlier, you're always going to find those extremes. It's easy to find the extreme bulls and the extreme bears. And I think you're better served as an investor if you can find people who are sort of in that middle, where they're able to provide some nuance, provide the risk factors. Like, yeah, I'm bullish on this company, but there's a scenario where they really get hit, and here's what that looks like. So I think finding those people, and they're usually not yellers. Michael Mobison, really smart guy, can't recall ever seeing him raise his voice once.
It's the moderate in the room. talking about this, I guess, this world of investing, and even, you know, even what you just said right now, you know, I think that we have a machine that's not built. It's built. I think that there's, you know, Munger says, you know, show me incentives, I'll show you people's behavior, right? And so we have, you know, you could tell I'm obviously a fan of those guys. And so I believe we have a system that disincentivizes long-term behavior. I believe that we have a system that incentivizes the loudest, squeakiest, oily rooms in the, you know, voices in the room, right? The squeaky wheels. And I think we also have a system that disincentivizes long-termism for shareholders, right? It's not about the stakeholder necessarily. It's around meeting that 13-week mark, that estimate you said you're going to put out, right? And what I've been, you know, I wrote a book 2 years ago, next month, called The Core Value Equation. And I'm a CEO and entrepreneur, and my belief is that core value-driven companies are going to overtake the markets over the next decade. And the reason I believe that is because price technology has become much more commoditized, and that what separates a good company from a great company, or a mediocre company from a great company, is the people that are there to make it happen. And I'll follow my sword all day long for that. I was having a conversation with a good friend of mine who's the CIO at a firm here in Austin. And I said, look, I think that there's a place for, you know, building portfolios around values-driven organizations. I believe that this is what's going to be the next leg in our investment world. What are your thoughts around this? It's one of the reasons I asked about what your values are, it's because I'm a core value evangelist, but what are your thoughts around where values, like where there, is there a place for this in the investing world?
There absolutely is. And I think it may not be the place a lot of people think it is. I think when a lot of people hear the word values attached to investing, they think of,
right,
you know, ESG, environmental, social, you know, corporate governance, that sort of thing. And they automatically go to, well, this is an ETF and all the companies in it have pledged to reduce their carbon footprint by 50% in the next 20 years, or, you know, whatever, that sort of thing. To me, the place I'm more interested in as an investor is to key in on a word you just used, and it's sort of the whole stakeholder approach. I think about a business like Costco, where Jim Sinegal, the co-founder and longtime CEO, he's no longer the CEO, but longtime CEO, Sinegal took, I would argue, a values-based approach to running Costco. It's just that it wasn't necessarily about the environment or climate, you know, or anything like that. It was around things like, it was clear that the company had a set of values. So there were, you know, just a couple of examples. For anyone who's ever shopped at Costco, they know this. If you're a Costco member, you shop there, and they have their own in-house brand, Kirkland. And I remember interviewing Sinegal and asking him one time, you know, look, this is working out for you. This is how big is this going to get? Would you ever spin off Kirkland into its own store? And he was very quick to say no. No, because we're going to cap the amount of products that are Kirkland branded, because our partners matter to us. We don't want to cannibalize our partners. So the people who shop here expect to have some choices. They didn't come here just to shop at Kirkland stuff, although we take pride in the Kirkland branded stuff that we make. But we're not going to do that. And even something as symbolic as the hot dog and soda at Costco, which is $1.50, and Sinegal, you know, before he stepped down as CEO, he said that no, it's always going to be $1.50. he said maybe after I'm dead, like he would make that joke, like, you know, when I'm, you know, someone asked him one time, like, oh, you know, what would you say if you heard that the price of the hot dog and soda was going up? And he said, oh, I would be dead. That's my assumption, because they'll do it over my dead body. But it really is that approach. The last thing on Costco is Costco's commitment to their customers is, we're never going to mark up anything in the store more than 15%. Never. And when Senegal would do quarterly conference calls with Wall Street analysts, invariably one of them would try to get him to commit to raising that. They would say, look, you know, I've run the numbers. You don't even have to increase it that much. Increase it to 16%, 17%. It's just 1 or 2 percentage points. It doesn't really matter. Your customers aren't going to notice. And Senegal's like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to do that to our customers. We've made this commitment. And so when I think about, you know, values in a business, that's the company.
That was the company I was thinking of before you said it, by the way. and you know, I saw this, I think it was in Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, where they were talking, where they compared the Costco stock to GE stock. Now, and this was written a while ago when GE was, you know, performing much better. But when you look at it over a 30-year period, it's like one of the best stocks ever. When you look at it over that time period and beat people that had crushed it for maybe even 10 or 20 years. And it just has this upward trend. I do believe that you know, there's a discipline around it, because he's got it, you know, you as a leader have to go and fly in the face of, and I do think this is where the CEO matters, right? Because if the CEO was worried about the quarter and not worried about the decade, they would change every single thing you just said. It'd be $3 hot dogs 5 years ago. It would be $3 Cokes. You know, maybe we're at $4 on hot dogs right now because of inflation. You know, that'd be a $7 meal, not a $2 meal. And that 15% would have been 17% with a bat of an eye, right? And this is what most of these other companies do. And then I believe what it does is it sends this message to everyone that this is a transaction. This is not a relationship, right? And by the way, you're a transaction. And then what does the consumer do? They go, fine, you're a transaction too. I'm going to shop you against Amazon. And if you're more expensive by $1, I'm buying from somewhere else. So I really appreciate what you just said, because I think that the stakeholder mindset, which I'm a firm believer in, disincentivizes the short-term thinking. But at the same time, you know, it you have to have that discipline. You have to be able to have even courage to say, yeah, I don't care, analyst from, you know, Goldman, like, go pound sand, right? And so what do you think, like, when you think of, you know, and I think this is like what we're talking about right now is completely the exception, right? What do you think it's going to take for that to become the norm? Because I think what we have a crisis right now, it's being created by this transactionship that we see on Wall Street.
I think that time is the great healer in this situation, that the longer, you know, in the same way that the longer you invest in the stock market, the greater the chances of your reward. You know, the market can drop in any 6, 12, 18 month period. But, you know, if you hold in for 10, 20, if your time horizon is 10, 20, 30 years instead of 10, 20, 30 months, you're going to be much better off. And I do think that eventually the businesses like Costco begin to separate themselves, and it's just so much harder for those flash in the pan businesses to compete. But you're right. It's not as common as it should be. And it's, you hear the phrase, you know, win-win scenario, where it's like, hey, here's a partnership. We're both going to win. That's easy to say. It's a lot harder to put into practice. You know, I remember, I forget what the business was, but I remember, you know, for Costco doesn't carry a ton of inventory. Like if you go in to buy ketchup, right, you're going to get 2 or 3 choices. That's it. So they don't, you know, and the vendors who sell those products, they really want to be in Costco. So they're going to, make their pitch, to Costco's benefit. And I forget the business, but I remember hearing a story one time about a business that was pitching to get their product inside of Costco, and they were about to close the deal. And Senegal had one of his people run the numbers and basically figured out that this company is going to go out of business in a couple of years, because they've basically pitched us a plan where they're losing money. And that, like, and so then in 2 years, they're going to be out of business. We're going to have to go find another vendor. So they went back and were like, hey, look, we like you. Well, let's figure out a way to make this work so that you're not losing money on every transaction. So it's, maybe this is a flaw, but I'm fundamentally optimistic that quality wins out over time, and that the businesses that are just like, we're just going to try and screw our customers and screw our partners. And it's like, Definitely. Okay, that can work for a short amount of time. But I don't know of anyone doing that over a 10, 20 year period and it working for them. You know, it's like Ponzi schemes. Like eventually
it's got to be, it's going to fall apart. It means that everyone needs to make money or else there is no business. Right. And I've yet to find, I mean, there are definitely are like tech companies that never make a profit that we could go into, but that's not what the idea that they want at some point. Well, here we are, top of the hour. You know, I mean, obviously, you guys have so much going on over at Motley Fool Money and at Motley Fool. If people want to connect with you guys or learn more about the shows, like, what's the best place for them to learn more?
Whatever podcast app you use, you can just find Motley Fool Money, or you can find Rule Breaker Investing with David Gardner. And I'll give a shout out. We have an office in Australia, and my colleague Scott Phillips in Australia hosts a weekly podcast also called Motley Fool Money. Different logos, though. So check out Motley Fool Money. If you hear an Australian accent at the start, you've got the one down.
Is his name Chris as well?
If you hear my voice.
Oh, okay, good. That would be confusing.
No, his name is Scott Phillips, and he's brilliant. And by the way, for any investor who's looking for, I mean, you know, we were talking earlier about, sort of how do you find different perspectives? That's a show that's got a perspective on the market from people who are in Australia, smart investors in Australia. And some of the companies they're talking about are American companies, but some of them are international stocks that you're probably not going to hear about on the show that I host. So I would say, check out whatever podcast.
Chris, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show and to spend time with you, and appreciate all the greatness you're bringing into the world.
You are listening to The Greatness Machine, and that's a wrap for today. Listen, if you love what you heard, subscribe to the show on whatever podcast platform that you're tuning in on so that you don't miss any of our future episodes. We have tons of great people coming on, and we're stoked to have you here to enjoy it with us. Leave us a review. Tell us what you love most about this particular episode. We love getting the reviews. We love to see what you guys love most. And if this particular episode, made you think of someone who's leveling up in their business and in their life, print screen, share it with them. Leaders are the best givers. And after all, we're all here to support and grow with each other. And in case you want to see some of the fun behind the scenes shots or some of the things that we're doing, I'm actually writing about this in my weekly newsletter. Go to www.therealdarius.com and subscribe to my newsletter. We're talking about fun things like business and life and mindfulness and cryptocurrencies and gosh, I don't even know, everything and anything, but it's tons of fun stuff I write about. I try to get it out on a weekly basis. You can subscribe at www.therealdarius.com. And with that said, look, thank you guys so much. I appreciate you. I love you. Peace. We're out of here. See you guys on the next one.
Hey there, what's up, everybody? Darius here, and I'm here to tell you about my main man, Robert Glazer, and his amazing show, The Elevate Podcast. Robert is a buddy of mine, and his Elevate Podcast is second to none. So The Elevate Podcast, what is it? It's a conversational show where Robert sits down with world-class CEOs, New York Times best-selling authors, and the best thought leaders and performers in their field. You're going to hear stories about triumph, failure, resilience, more importantly, all the learnings along the way. So some of his guests include James Clear from Atomic Habits, Angela Duckworth from Grit, Susan Cain, author of Quiet, Morning Brew founder and CEO Alex Lieberman, and hundreds more. Every episode shares valuable insights in how to expand your capabilities as a leader and align your life and work to your most important principles. Robert's goal is that you're going to leave each episode inspired and with plenty of next steps that you can put into practice into your life. And look, if you're looking to elevate your life, your leadership, and your business, Elevate is the show for you. It's like I always say, we as podcast listeners, we listen to 6 shows, not just mine, but Bob should be one of yours. Subscribe to the Elevate Podcast today on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Check it out.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting podcast, or YAP, like it's often called by my YAP fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.